We're here with Fletcher Prouty. This is May 5th, 1989, and we're going to be discussing aspects of American history through starting from at some point before World War II and going up to the present day. To start out with and establish a frame of reference to everything that we will be discussing, why don't you give an overview of your 23 years of active military service in the United States Air Force and where that really started and how you got into it?
Well, I came on duty before the beginning of World War II. I went to the University of Massachusetts and they had an ROTC program. And in those days, the mid-30s, very few of us knew anything about the military, least of all about ROTC. What I observed was that out on campus there were some horses, and being a city boy, I didn't know anything about a horse, and I asked whose horses they were, and they belonged to the Army. So we had a compulsory freshman year ROTC, which was book work, but the second year they taught us to ride horses, because this was a cavalry unit, and for me that was new. Leading the horse was something, riding him was really something else. And for the junior and senior year, you had to be selected to go into the course because that led to being commissioned as an officer in the reserves with the U.S. Army. And I was selected, one of 22 men, to go in there. And that meant we practically had our own horse. 3 days a week we rode horses, and we, of course, were getting cavalry training and cavalry education in our classes. The summer between junior and senior year, we actually took 40 horses and rode over 600 miles on horseback as an army march. As you know, we really experienced what it's like to take sixes for 600 miles. At the end of our senior year, when it came time for graduation, we received rolled up in our diploma, our orders to active duty. We weren't drafted, we weren't asked whether we wanted to go or not, we were just given orders and off we went to, I went to Pine Camp, up in Watertown, New York, which was the 4th Armored Division.
That was what year?
That was in 1941 on about July 10th, somewhere around there. In other words, World War II was going in Europe. We were not involved directly, and the Army was beginning to build new divisions. One of them was this 4th Armored Division in northern New York. The Army had decided to do away with horses, and we had no horse cavalry to be ordered to. Well, something interesting. Little things that happen sometimes lead to important things down the line. The very first man that I reported to as an officer when I came on duty that day was Creighton W. Abrams, who became Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army and was our commander in Vietnam years later. Abrams was from my own hometown, Springfield, Massachusetts. He was a graduate of West Point, famous for his football playing, a very skilled officer with a terrific career during World War II, where he was the brigade commander for General Patton's lead brigade of the Third Army that crashed across Europe, defeated the Germans, and shook hands with the Russians. A terrific man, Creighton Abrams. So he was the very first man I reported to in July of 1941 and had much to do with guiding my early career. Shortly after that, I got orders from Pine Camp, New York, to go to Fort Knox, Kentucky, to a communication officer's course. And while I was there, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. So then we were in the war. About a month and a half after that, I came back to the 4th Armored Division. And in some of the mail I picked up when I returned there was an offer from the U.S. Army Air Corps to fly in the Army, and I already had a flying license. I had been through flight training and a civilian course before, while I was in college. And since I had a license, the Air Force had taken the list of people with licenses, I'd written to me and said, if you want to transfer to the Air Force, you can stay in grade and go right along. So I talked to Captain Abrams, and he said, sure, it's all U.S. Army, we're doing this all together, we're for this Air Force business, why don't you go ahead? So I transferred down to Maxwell Field in Alabama and began flight training.
And that was about when?
That was in the, I think about May of 1942. I got my wings in November 10th of 1942. And immediately was ordered into the Air Transport Command and to a an assignment at the University of Vermont in Burlington, Vermont, which was very interesting. They taught us a lot about instrument flying and Arctic flying, because at that time there was the intent on the part of the U.S. Army that we were going into the north and help the Soviets, and of course we'd be exposed to flying Arctic weather and all that sort of thing in the transport command, as our divisions would be operating as ski divisions. And actually the 4th Armored Division had been issued skis and other northern gear so they could operate with the Russians in their territory. Well, now this is a sudden change of U.S. Army plans to have divisions operating on Soviet territory and to have us flying on Soviet territory. I've often wondered at why my orders went that way, because when I went to 4th Armored Division, I all of a sudden had to learn to ski and everything else, as well as drive tanks or operate tanks. And then when I went into the Air Force, I ended up with a comparable set of orders to Burlington, Vermont, and from Burlington I was transferred to northern Maine, to Presque Isle, Maine. We arrived when the temperature was about 30 below zero. And as things happen in the military sometimes, it was an abrupt shift, where there were 50-some young officers just out of flying school in this group in the Air Transport Command at Presque Isle, Maine. And I happened to be the only one that was a first lieutenant because of my prior duty with the Armored Force. So a telephone call one day came and they asked for me. It was from Washington. And they said, we want you to tell all 50 officers, and they read the list for me, that you are being transferred from Presque Isle, Maine, immediately to Palm Beach, Florida, en route to Africa for overseas service.
And that was when?
And that was, let me see, that was in probably February. Yes, that was in February of 1943. Okay. So we turned in all our Arctic gear, our fur-lined jackets and our heavy boots and everything, and drove to Palm Beach, Florida, and within a month or so, almost all 50 of us were in Africa. I was assigned to what in those days was called the Gold Coast, British West Africa, now is called Ghana. I flew out of a base at the city of Accra, a new air base that actually had been created by Pan American for an airline they planned to operate there before the war, called Pan Africa. Fortunately for us, many of our instructors over there were these Pan American pilots who had assumed their reserve commission ranks of captain and major, and they trained this group of new lieutenants that had just arrived. We began flying from Ghana across Africa to India. We flew to Cairo, we flew to North Africa. And at that time, it was not too long after the American invasion of North Africa, so that we could fly to Casablanca, to Oran, and to Algiers, but we could not fly to Tunis because the Germans held Tunis, and they held the desert all the way across to Egypt, so we couldn't fly in that part of North Africa. But as transport command pilots, we were flying both troops and supplies into this battle area. A lot of times we just landed on bare ground, unloaded the plane, and go back and get another load. It involved flying the Sahara Desert, sometimes as often as 5 days out of seven. And we, as we fly across the desert, we got to know the desert as well as we knew our home country. Interestingly there, we were immersed in flying. We got just an awful lot of flying, a lot of good experience with these Pan American pilots and pilots from other airlines. And one day, a lieutenant colonel who, to those of us who were lieutenants, was a pretty elevated rank in those days, and an older man who had been a vice president of Pan American, asked me to fly with him on a flight. I didn't realize it at the time, but it represented a personal checkout. He needed somebody to do some other flying. He wanted some experience with me. So we flew a few times together across Africa. And then he said, Lieutenant, we are going to use you now for a VIP pilot.
Who was this man?
His name was George Krager. Very, very interesting man. He was born in Yugoslavia. And he had a great interest in the Balkans through the war, and did some a lot of undercover work with units in the Balkans. But basically was a strong pilot, a good maintenance man, and a very knowledgeable airline type operator. I learned an awful lot from George Krager. What this meant for my career was that a few days later, I was notified that I was going to pick up a general in Casablanca and fly him wherever he wanted to go and as long as he needed a pilot and crew. Well, this turned out to be Major General Omar Bradley. Without question, one of the finest military men, one of the finest men I've ever met in my life. I knew General Bradley for many years, even when he was with the Bulova Watch Company after his retirement. We flew him into the battle zone areas of North Africa, in Constantine and areas near, I think it was called Tlergma, and Bone, and these are places just east of Algiers, over in where our army was fighting and getting its first taste of battle against the Germans. And General Bradley loved to fly. I mean, actually pilot the plane. He wasn't a pilot, but he liked to sit in a seat and fly the plane. So as soon as we get off the ground, I'd send my co-pilot back, invite the general up front, and he'd sit there and he'd fly the plane and really enjoyed it. But what I enjoyed was he looked down out of the plane, well, not very high, an old DC-3, very comfortable plane, and he'd tell me all the action that had taken place below. He'd say, now see those three tanks over there? Those are German tanks. We knocked them out last week. And now look over here. Well, you know, it's a terrific briefing of exactly how General Bradley was operating this campaign in North Africa. after that, I flew with him for a couple of weeks, and he was called back to England for some meetings.
What period was that?
This is about May of 43, April and May of 43, I'd say, about the best I can recollect. And then after that, I was asked to fly many different VIPs, each time a separate trip, and I was transitioned into a Lockheed Lodestar. We called it a C-57. Very nice little airplane for pilot point of view. It would take 6 to 8 passengers. It had been mahogany lined, and there was a typewriter in it, there was a bed in it, and it was a real nice plane for a general or some other official and his party. And it practically was my own airplane. I just flew it all the time. Had a very good co-pilot, and a radio man, and a flight engineer. Well, in October, I was told to get some new tires on the plane because I'd be going on a long trip. Went to Casablanca and picked up a man and his crew that were on the orders listed as a U.S. Geological Survey team. And had the plane ready for them when they arrived, I met Brigadier General C.R. Smith. Well, Smith was the founder and president of American Airlines. He's a Brigadier General in reserve duty with the Air Transport Command. An absolutely magnificent person. And we left Casablanca. He had three men with him who were geological survey team experts. And he told me we were going to Tehran. Well, I had been there, so it was a trip that I was quite familiar with. By that time, the Germans had surrendered at Cape Bon in Tunisia, and Africa was now open. We could fly all the way across North Africa to Cairo and from Cairo on to Tehran. I don't know if many people realize it, but at the surrender of the Germans in Cape Bon, more German troops surrendered to the British and American armies there than at any other time during World War II. It was an enormous victory when they wrapped up this campaign in North Africa against Rommel and his armies. The old Desert Fox had been the enemy and the opponent of General Montgomery and General Alexander and General Bradley for years. And I should take a minute out to tell you an experience there that I think was rather interesting. On the morning of the surrender, I had been flying General Bradley, and I was told to get my plane ready for another flight early in the morning. And I sat there in the cockpit of the plane and looked out across this big open area north of Bazerte in North Africa, and thousands of German soldiers lined up and marched out to surrender. And as they did, they were singing, and they sang the Australian marching song, Waltzing Matilda. Well, the Australians and the British always marched to that song, but at the time of the surrender, the Germans sang that song. And you never heard anything so thrilling as tens of thousands of German troops yelling this Waltzing Matilda to their adversaries, to whom they were surrendering, the British and the Australians and the Americans who were lined up on the other side of the field. Then the British and the Australians and the Americans came out to accept the surrender of the Germans. And what did they sing? Lille Marlena, the German song. Now, there's something about this hostility of two great armies. It's like the hostility of two great football teams. They're adversaries, but they understand each other. I wouldn't say they had become friends, but you can see just in the way the songs were done and the whole surrender ceremony, which for the Germans was a very sad event, you know, and how it was handled. It was really something. I don't think warfare has reached that level since then. Huh. Well, as immediately as the surrender was over, which amounted to their stacking their arms and turning everything over, and then finally the German generals up front, led by a lieutenant general whose name I fail to recall, 11 generals, I believe, surrendered to General Montgomery, and that phase of the war was over. Well, within minutes of that, some vehicles started coming toward my plane through the dust of the field, right up to the plane, and an American officer said, "You're going to take these passengers to Casablanca." And he put these 11 German generals on my airplane. Well, I didn't have a gun, I have a pistol, I had nothing on board the plane. I presumed they weren't armed, but there were 11 of them. And I got thinking, you know, I'll sit up there in this plane flying along, and they'll come up front and they'll say, "Hey, fly this across the Mediterranean and take us back to Germany." I said, "Well, how am I going to?" So I told the generals that I didn't have much gas and I had to land at Algiers to get some gas, and then we'd go on to Casablanca. They wanted to know where I was going to take them. I found out that the Germans, most of them spoke English. One of them was a graduate of New York University, and I forgot another was from another American college. And I sat in the back of the plane while my co-pilot flew the plane talking with him most of the way from Tunis to Casablanca, which in those days took about 7 hours, an old DC-3. And that was very interesting. For instance, one of the German generals, in talking with me, found out that I had been with Armored Force. He said, "Oh, then you can tell us about American artillery." He said, "How does the American automatic artillery work?" He said, we have been fighting the British for years, and then when we came to the Americans, all of a sudden we were hit with automatic artillery. How does that work?" Well, I knew that Fort Sill had developed a method of using artillery which would appear to bring down all the guns at once by firing a single gun off at an angle, and then by using trigonometry, studying the degree of the angle, and by using aerial photographs, the elevation of the land, and they were able then to move all the guns on the target instantly, and the Germans thought it was our... So I told them, I said, "I don't have the slightest idea, I wasn't going to tell them." But I took these Germans into Casablanca, and I understand that, I never knew during the war where they went, but I understand they were kept so-called prisoners at the Greenbrier restaurant, in the Greenbrier Hotel down in West Virginia, and that was the end of the war for them. It was an interesting little incident because, frankly, for an hour or so, I was a little concerned about how to handle 11 German generals. They were gentlemen, and I'll tell you one thing, I don't think they wanted to go across the Mediterranean. For them, the war was over. That was the end of it. They'd had their war. But I was telling you then, we were going with the Geological Survey team a few months later, and this is how we could fly across Africa because the Germans had surrendered. We got into Cairo, flew from Cairo to Tehran. Tehran in those days is very interesting because an enormous number of refugees had slipped across the border of Iran into Iran that predominantly were Russian Jewish people who were fleeing the German armies that were coming into Russia. So Tehran is a very, very busy place. After a couple of days there, General Smith said, "We're going down to Bahrain, an island in the Persian Gulf." And as we landed at Bahrain, he came over to me and he said, "Here's some money. I want you to go in town and buy some paint and some civilian clothes." And he said, "I want you to paint your airplane. Paint, obscure the U.S. Air Force markings on it, obscure the numbers on it, all the identification, the visible identification. And I don't want you in uniform tomorrow. I want you to be in civilian clothes, you and your crew." And I said, "What does that mean?" He said, "Well, just don't have your insignia on and see if you can get another kind of a shirt or something than our khaki clothes." Well, we did. We went in town and we bought colored shirts and we bought a red necktie and all that sort of thing. So we were civilians. And the sergeant painted over the plane. And then the general came out and he said, Now, this morning, we're going to fly across the rest of the Persian Gulf, very small, 15, 20 miles, into Saudi Arabia. Well, we all knew that we had to avoid Saudi Arabia. It was neutral, and we were not allowed to fly over him. For all the flying we had done in the Middle East, we'd avoid Saudi Arabia. But the general said he had special permission for this flight, and that when I got over the sands of Saudi Arabia, right across the beach, that I should find, I should spot a vehicle there, and that that vehicle would break open a barrel of oil and drive across the desert on an area that was smooth, and I would land in the direction of the line of that oil, which made a pretty good deal. So I circled the place a few times after I saw them running this line of oil across the sand and realized it looked firm enough and it looked smooth enough, so I landed on it. It was beautiful, good as any airport I ever landed on. Well, it turned out that General Smith had been sent there to meet the representatives of the California Standard Oil Company, who were holding their U.S. franchise on the oil fields of Arabia, Saudi Arabia. This was a really very important contact with the Saudi Arabians and with the oil industry.
And that was in October of 1943.
October of 1943.
Okay.
And we got out of the plane, and they very kindly took the whole crew, as well as the general's party, and drove us over to an area where there were some oil pipes that I would say were 10-inch pipes sticking out of the ground maybe a foot with caps on them. They'd unlock a cap, spin it off, and oil would just bubble out of the ground by itself. No pump, no nothing. All they said was, "General, come and get it and you're going to have all you want. You know, there's oil here for years." Well, remember, this is 43, and I've been pumping that oil ever since.
Now, they said general, but the general was the person from Standard Oil?
No, the general was Smith. He was the president of American Airlines. He was a Texan. His party were the Geological Survey people. He was just head of the party. So he represented the U.S. government for them, and they were representatives of California Standard Oil Company, later known as Aramco, or later founders of Aramco.
Okay.
They told us that although they were living comfortably in the sands of Arabia, we couldn't see any buildings, we couldn't see, there were no trees, there were no roads, there was nothing in that part of Arabia in those days. They said, "If you don't mind, for lunch, we'll get in this little boat we have and go out and see if we can catch a fish or two, and we'll eat the fish." Well, that seemed pretty good. So we got in the boat, and not long after that, we caught enough fish. We went on shore. They had a Filipino cook. He cooked the fish, and I forgot what else we had, but we had our lunch there. We took off that afternoon, went back to Bahrain, spent the night there. But that's the first clandestine exercise I was ever involved in. We went in as though we were civilians just by painting the plane.
And that was to avoid the necessity of appearing to violate the neutrality of Saudi Arabia as opposed to us, as opposed to the Russians?
Right. It was purely a formality, so that the Saudi Arabians, if our plane had been detected by anyone in Bahrain or anywhere else, could say that only a civilian plane had visited them and had to do with the oil party that held the franchise in their country, and that would be okay. What we had done is remove our insignia, the general removed his insignia, and it's purely formality. It's part of the way you do clandestine exercises anywhere. You set up your agreements, then you follow them. That visit to Saudi Arabia was much more important than we realized at the time, because the Cairo conference between the British and Americans, Churchill, Roosevelt, and Chiang Kai-shek, took place only a month later. And one of the decisions of that period was to erect immediately, without delay, right during the war, I think it was a 50,000 barrel refinery right there on that place called Ras Tanura on the coast of Arabia. So you will see that we were planning on the use of Arabian oil even during World War II if we needed it. So oil was one of the biggest things we needed in those days, fuel. So that small visit, but important visit, played a key role in the development of the Saudi Arabian oil assets even during World War II, which we didn't realize at the time, at least I didn't, but I'm sure General Smith knew why he had been sent there. I took General Smith from there to Karachi, which at that time was in India, but hadn't divided into Pakistan, and left him there. flew back to Casablanca, and then this Colonel Krager, who had started me doing the VIP flying, said we were going to fly to Cairo for a while, and we'd operate out of Cairo. And I didn't say why, but that afternoon I met some American pilots who were civilian employees and civilian pilots with American Airlines who had come over from Washington, and they told me that they were going to fly President Roosevelt's party from their landing in North Africa to Cairo at the end of November. And they wanted to know the safest air route from the North Africa to Cairo and so on. So that was when I began to realize that something was beginning to happen scheduled in Cairo, which later became the Cairo conference at the end of November. So General Colonel Krager and I went to Cairo, and we established an operating base there because during the Cairo conference, Cairo being in the reach of German bombers, we had to be very careful to separate the staffs and protect them from being all in one place. Much of the British staff stayed up in Palestine, which we call Israel now, but in Palestine. The American staff was separated around, and they needed aircraft to fly them back and forth and all that, and that's, they assigned that job to me. So I stayed during the Cairo conference and did a lot of flying in and out of that area while they were meeting. And then from there, one morning was told to take a group to Tehran. So I went out to the plane early and was told I was taking a Chinese group to Tehran. Well, the Chinese had been at the Cairo conference, so I knew they were in the area, but I was surprised to find that they were going to Tehran. I think about six or eight men came in the plane, and I flew them to Habaniya in Iraq for refueling from Habaniya up to Tehran. And when I landed in Tehran, I landed right behind a very distinctive plane that that Churchill flew in, called a York. And when we left the airport, which was a few miles out of town, our party with the Chinese was just behind the Churchill's party of British going into Tehran. Well, during the Tehran conference, the Russians were in control of the security of the city of Tehran. And as we approached the city, the center of the city, the entire area was enclosed with about a 12 to 15 foot high wall of purple cloth, heavy purple cloth. It really a striking thing. And it circled the entire city. Now the object of it was anybody inside the purple cloth was cleared for the conference. Anyone outside was not cleared and nobody was allowed through the cloth. It's a pretty good way of setting up security quickly. And all around that purple cloth there were Russian soldiers carrying automatic weapons. And as our two small caravans of cars approached the gate up, through this cloth wall, Churchill's party was stopped for quite a long time. And of course that meant we were stopped. And the Chinese were talking with us, if we asked if we knew anything about what the delay was and all, and we didn't know. It turned out that Churchill was traveling in his wartime, what would you call, jumpsuit. Single piece suit with a zipper up the front, you know, had nothing in his pockets, no ID, no nothing. He was smoking his typical cigar, but the Russia, it wasn't good enough for the Russians. No matter what he said he was, if he didn't have his ID, they weren't going to let him through that. And even the British were all laughing. They didn't know what to do. They couldn't get through. Finally, the Russians got some other official up to the gate who certified that this was Winston Churchill and let him through. But it seemed kind of strange at the peak of the war for the Russians to keep Churchill out of Tehran. That only lasted about 15, 20 minutes. Then we got up to the gate, and all our Chinese guests had their adequate ID. We had no trouble. We got through that big purple cloth without any trouble. And the conference lasted for a few days, and it was an extremely significant conference with respect to Asia and the Indochina War. And I don't think people have considered that in the context of modern history and what the decisions of Tehran had to do with later activities in Southeast Asia. Because one reason that the Chinese had gone to Tehran was to prevail upon Stalin to ask Mao Zedong to withhold a tax against Chiang Kai-shek so that Chiang Kai-shek could use all of his forces against the Japanese and help us get air bases that we needed for the B-29s in China so we could attack Japan directly from air bases in China. It was a very important decision that they were being asked to get Churchill to make. And Tung did withhold his attack on Chiang Kai-shek.
Now, the Tehran Conference, as far as the public and historians are concerned, was primarily a conference between Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin. And it's all a matter of record and doesn't bear repeating here. But there was an additional factor that historians have not dealt with, and that was that the Chinese attended the Tehran Conference also. And this is very important because decisions made at Tehran regarding China impacted very definitely years later upon the Indochina War and the conditions in Southeast Asia, and we'll pursue that. But what the problem was we were allied with the Soviets during World War II. And we were not allied, or Chiang Kai-shek was certainly not allied, with the Chinese Communists, which presented a rather fragmented situation when British and Americans tried to persuade Chiang Kai-shek to attack the Japanese and drive them into the Pacific, attack them east. He had a problem at his rear, his military rear, because every time he would move any troops from his rear, Mao Tse-tung would move his communist armies against them, and Chiang Kai-shek was fighting in two directions. One direction against our common enemy, the Japanese, and the other direction against our Soviet friends, our Soviet allies, and their allies, the communist Chinese. A bit complex. So what Roosevelt had worked out was he felt that if he could get the Chinese to talk with Stalin and have Stalin prevail upon Mao Tse-tung at least to withhold attack during the war against Japan, then he would free a considerable force of Chiang Kai-shek's so that he could use that force against the Japanese and gain bases in China that we would use then for the new B-29 bombers that were just coming into play to bomb against the homeland of Japan. Now, Roosevelt was a very thorough person, and just to give you a little idea of how he handled all this, when I got on board that plane of mine, that C-57 that morning in Cairo, I found that there were two or three very large cartons in the plane that somebody had put there. And since we were just flying passengers, we were going to throw those cartons out. We figured they put them on the wrong plane. But a major who had come, a protocol officer who had come from Washington, told me we had to keep them on the plane. Well, it was okay with us. Shortly after we had taken off, I went back to see how my Chinese passengers were doing. They had broken open the carton. Inside were boxes of cornflakes, just simple boxes of cornflakes. No sugar and cream, no bowls and spoons, just cornflakes. Roosevelt knew that the Chinese loved cornflakes and that they would eat the cornflakes like we eat popcorn. And every one of the Chinamen back in my plane had an open box of cornflakes and was eating cornflakes as we flew along. Now, how did Roosevelt know that? How had it happened that he had thought of this whole event so meticulously that he even ordered the cornflakes to be on board? Well, that's one of those events that makes a diplomatic meeting a success. And the success at Tehran at that time enabled Chiang Kai-shek to move his troops and for us to then put much more pressure on the Japanese and to win the war. It did a lot of things, because in making the agreement with Stalin that we would invade Europe at Normandy, Stalin played his cards close. He talked to Mao Tse-tung. There's plenty of evidence about that. And exactly 1 week after we invaded Normandy, on the beaches of Normandy, Mao Tse-tung publicly allied himself with Chiang as Chiang moved against the Japanese. In other words, they timed it so that we land on the beach and then they'll announce the agreement with Mao Tse-tung. Pretty clever operation. Now, in that period of time, Chiang Kai-shek, who certainly was not any favorite of the communist Chinese or any other communist, also had as a guest in his country Ho Chi Minh, who was, in his eyes, a Vietnamese nationalist whose greatest aim in life was to get the colonialism, the French colonialism, period ended in Vietnam. And Chiang was in favor of that, as were the American generals, General Stilwell and all who were with Chiang, General Chennault. So that the American generals, our OSS, and Chiang Kai-shek supported Ho Chi Minh when, even before the end of the war, they sent Ho Chi Minh down into Indochina and started his action against renegade Japanese there, and greatly influenced his activities in Vietnam, coalesced his people there in armed troops that we armed, all as a result of what started in Tehran. Mm-hmm. Rather interesting thing, and of course we'll talk about that later, but I wanted to emphasize that because some people have tried to prevail upon the fact that there were no Chinese during the Tehran conference. I was the pilot of the plane that flew them there, and I know now there are books printed, even by the government printing office, that state that Chiang Kai-shek was in Tehran with Churchill, Roosevelt, and Stalin. Now, you see, this VIP pilot business that I got into, I had no idea that I'd be in that kind of work. It was rather interesting work. I flew many other people like that. I flew the Turkish ambassador who had been at the Bretton Woods conference here in New Hampshire during the war back to Turkey. And a very interesting man talked to me about what had been going on at Bretton Woods as we flew north. I had him sit up in the co-pilot seat. I don't think he'd ever done much flying. We were flying in an area where there were little puffy white clouds up in the sky, and I didn't try to avoid them. I just fly through them. Well, I noticed the first time I approached a cloud at DC-3, no, I 57, at C-57 speed, about 160 miles an hour, he tried to hide under the seat because he thought it was going to be a crash. Then after that, he wanted me to go hunt clouds. He wanted to fly through a lot of them. You know, you find interesting little things happen in these details. As we approached Turkey, he made a statement that's rather interesting. He said, fly over by those mountains. There's some beautiful mountains at the south of Turkey near Adana. And we went over there and he said, see that lake? And I looked down and he said, that's not a lake, that's oil. He said, Turkey has an enormous amount of oil. He said, but we have made it national policy that we will not export oil. Oil is Turkey's, it's for us, and we will consume our own oil. Now that was in 1944. I have not heard of any commercial development of Turkish oil since then. I think what he said was a true fact, and that it still is their policy. But we looked down and saw plenty. Of course, there was Turkish oil before World War II. They were in the oil market then. This flying into Turkey led to one or two other incidents which were rather interesting. I was called up there another day. I had a passport. See, Turkey was neutral also, but I didn't have to paint my plane to go into Turkey because they were very meticulous. If they let my airplane in, they would let a German airplane in. So I got called to fly up to Ankara, Turkey one day, and as I approached the airport in Ankara, I saw another airplane. And as I circled to land, I saw the other fellow circle to land. I parked my plane on the ramp, and he parked his. I was right beside a German airplane. They picked us up in the same bus. Here, my American crew and the German crew, and we went into the same hotel in town. That's how neutral the Turks were. They kept us on an even keel. My visit there was rather interesting because the next morning, they got me up early, got the plane ready, and they rushed out to the field with four or five British soldiers. And I had been asked to bring a nurse up there, by the way, and I didn't know why that was. But then I realized it, and we saw those soldiers. These were the British commandos who had blown up the guns at Navarone, one of the great undercover incidents of World War II. These British commandos, acting as native fishermen, had started somewhere around Latakia in the Mediterranean, sailed up into the Bosphorus, to the Greek side of the Bosphorus, to where these huge guns were based at Navarone. They overlooked the Bosphorus and stopped any movement of shipping through there up to the Black Sea, or out of the Black Sea. And these five men, I think it was five, had blown up those guns. Well, on their way in, unfortunately, one of the men had stepped on a landmine on the beach. And the other fellows told me that they begged him to leave him behind. Just he tried to do the best he could, but he'd been badly wounded. One leg was shattered. But they wouldn't. They dragged him up to the guns. After the guns, they escaped. They put him in the boat and went across to Turkey. And they escaped with him. And when we got to him, his leg was very bad, gangrene had set in, and the nurse worked with him all the way back, and we took him to a big British Army hospital that was in Palestine. But it's kind of an interesting incident to think the damage that those five men had, wow, had done in their own operation. Another visit to Turkey was equally significant, because we were asked to go to a small airbase near the Syrian city of Aleppo. And from there, we went up north to an open field. There was no airbase. And we were asked to decide whether or not we could operate aircraft out of that field, because it was near the railroad track. And there's a railroad track that comes down from Turkey on its way across easterly, and for a few miles, drops a few miles below the Turkish-Syrian border. So the track is actually running in Syria at that time, or the train is running in Syria. So I agreed that we could use that as an airbase, and I asked, you know, how many planes they wanted, what we were supposed to do, and they said, well, we're going to have a train come down here in a few days with about 750 men who are former prisoners of war, as the German army was retreating out of the Balkans and the Russian army was coming in. There was a little hiatus there in which our OSS officials were able to liberate many of the American prisoners who had been shot down over the Balkans during the war. Well, I figured out for 750 men I'd need about 30 airplanes. We could get 30 airplanes up there, and we agreed to be there. So we got orders about 3 days later to be there, and we took off from Cairo. I had unloaded every plane coming into Cairo for a while until I got 30 extra planes, and we flew up there and picked up these men, and as soon as we filled each plane, we flew them out. Well, I had taken my commander's airplane.
Who was that?
My commander was Colonel Smith, R.J. Smith. R.J. Smith had been a vice president of Braniff Airline and was serving in his reserve commission as a colonel, later general, as the commanding officer of the Cairo John B. Payne Air Base. And his plane had comfortable seats, and we had some cots in there, and we picked up the men who had been injured. Injuries to the prisoners mostly were the result of a very brutal action by the native Balkans to keep the prisoners from running away. They cut a leg off. And here we had these one-legged airmen who had no injuries other than the fact they cut their leg off at the knee, and we had put them in we carried them into the seats of the plane. And amazingly, I had a whole plane full of probably 30, 35 men. That we had the one man that had both legs cut off. Just unfortunate type thing. They were in fairly good health, but it's a pretty brutal way to keep people prisoners, and certainly not in accordance with the agreements on the treatment of prisoners of war.
But as you had also said in the past, those people had done that because of their anger at the people, these bombers, people who had bombed them.
Our bombing attacks on the oil fields at Ploiești in Romania and all were of course, devastating attacks, but we had to limit the supply of oil to the Germans as a reason for it, even though we were not specifically at war with some of the people there, the Romanians, the Bulgarians, and so on. The interesting thing about that was that once we got in the air, I realized that some of my passengers were not these American pilots. They were men from the Balkans. In fact, we were talking, and then later on learned that they were people who had been selected by the OSS in the Balkans for special evacuation before the Soviet armies arrived, because if they were not exactly Nazis, they had been pro-Nazi, and for some reason our own OSS wanted to get them out of there. This puzzled us a little bit, but we weren't in the political business, so we didn't ask too many questions. But I've done a lot of thinking since those, especially since the publication of this book, Blowback, and others, that shows that we exfiltrated thousands of ex-Nazis out of Germany for various reasons after World War II.
How did you find out at the time that these people were, in fact, not allies? They were not.
Well, one of two things that I have never written about or really never spoken about before today is these men very freely gave me an ID that, you know, I want to know by what right they were on the plane. And I could tell from the IDs, one or two of which I have kept, still have. I have their names and things like that. And then I learned from later associations in my career that this group, some of them, did contain men who had been selected by Frank Wisner of the OSS, who he was the chief in Budapest, and in, I should say, Bucharest. And they had come out, and that they were selected for various reasons. And again, I had no way of knowing. They were just my passengers. But it's an interesting little incident because, as we all know, even before the end of World War II, Alan Dulles, who was in Geneva, was dealing with General Galen and others for an early surrender of the generals as they revolted against Hitler at the end of the war. So this was a lead by maybe, this was August of 44, this was a lead of 8 or 9 months before the end of the war, in which we were already negotiating with Germans for the surrender of the war and for their own escape from Soviets who were coming in. A very interesting prelude to things that were coming. A third episode with this flying into Turkey is also rather interesting. It's hard to contemplate how during a world war, when the forces, when millions of forces are against each other, there can be activities through the lines. And our Army Counterintelligence Corps learned that the Germans were smuggling enormous amounts of gold from Germany through the Balkans into Turkey. And oddly enough, I mean oddly to me, just a Joe pilot flying around, through American facilities to Argentina. Well, immediately, Army CIC realized that the only going concern that they could have been operating with would be the Air Transport Command, because no one else flew. The commercial airlines weren't in business. So they began to watch the Air Transport Command very closely. And they realized that one or two members, or at least one or two, made trips that didn't seem to have anything to do with their normal business. And that these trips included the proximity to Turkey. So they called me in one day because I had a Turkish passport. I was the only pilot that had a regular Turkish passport. My crew was selected for each flight. They didn't need a passport because I had one, at least for wartime, that sufficed. But I could go to Turkey without raising eyebrows, without having somebody observe it. So they wanted me to go to Adana, Turkey, go to certain restaurants and look to see if I saw any people that weren't Turks, you know, or Germans or whatever, Americans. Just keep an eye on what was going on while I was having dinner and that kind of thing. A very simple requirement, but it meant somebody had to go there to observe what was going on. And sure enough, I did see some people that didn't look as though they were our military or theirs or had any real business in Turkey. And I told these people in Cairo. And oh, a month later, this same Colonel Krager, whom I worked with so much, called me one day and said, I want you to meet me at Shepherd's Hotel. So I went down there in the afternoon and we sat on the veranda, the marvelous old Shepherd's Hotel. Unfortunately, it was destroyed in some riots later on, but it was just a grand old hotel. And during World War II, it was quite the social meeting place for the coming and going of the armies traveling through Cairo. I met him there and he said, I want you to stay here with me and we'll just sit out on the veranda and watch what goes on. He said, I expect that a taxi cab, or maybe two, will pull up and certain people will get out of the cab. And if by any chance you see someone you saw in Turkey, just nod your head. He said, on the veranda there are a number of CIC people and they'll do the rest. All you have to do is just nod your head. So I sat there and we sipped a drink for a while and watched the crowds. And sure enough, up came a taxi and out of the cab popped an American in uniform, but he was a man I had seen, and I nodded my head, and immediately about 10 CIC men got up, surrounded him, and off he went. I never saw him again, at least for a while. Interestingly, and he was tried as being working with the Germans in this, and they broke the whole gold smuggling ring by trying him and finding out who the other people were, and really it was quite a, the CIC did a magnificent job that ended it. But what interested me was that the man that they captured was a very famous Hollywood movie actor named Bruce Cabot, a very close friend of Errol Flynn's, and you know the many allegations that Errol Flynn was closely connected with Nazis and so on. I assume Cabot must have been because he was in the gold smuggling ring. Cabot's regular base for us, he was the Air Transport Command operation officer in Tunis. He was first lieutenant in the U.S. Air Force, and he was running the our end of the gold smuggling ring. He'd see that the gold got to Brazil labeled as spare parts or things like that, and then from Brazil it would get down to Argentina by other devices. But it was an interesting little interlude in the wartime. So VIP flying opened doors to people and to incidents that, as just an ordinary transport pilot, I never would have even conceived of. And I didn't realize it, but apparently some of this is kept on a record, because when they want somebody to do things somewhat similar to that later, rather than train a person, they'll use one that's already had the training, and it limits the knowledge of these things down to a few people. And things like this occurred again. But I had been in Africa then for 19 months. I'd been up in the Soviet Union. We had interesting flights into the Soviet Union at the same time. Before I came back, we went up there. At one of the conferences, it was agreed that we could do shuttle bombing. Bombers would take off from England, go deep over Germany, and then rather than return back across the length of Germany, they would just continue a few more miles into Russia and land there, and then fly sort of around the battle areas into Italy, and then from Italy back to England. And they figured there would be much less loss of bombers if they could run shuttle bombing. They did that without figuring that the Soviets were not as operationally efficient against aerial attack as we thought they were. And the Germans followed our bombers and saw that they had gone into a place called Poltava and Mirgorod and Pirgorod, and came over that same night and destroyed almost every single B-17. I think there were 77 destroyed out of 80 bombers. Wow. Terrific loss of planes. We didn't have much loss of life. The people had been moved to some other place. And we got a call in Cairo again to come up immediately and be ready to evacuate over 700 men. So the old deal again, get 30 or 40 planes together and off we go. Well, from Cairo, we took, I think, about 40 airplanes to Tehran, and then flew all the way from Tehran up over the Caspian Sea, across the Ukraine to Rostov, and from Rostov, we used a railroad track for navigation up to Poltava or Mirgorod and landed. We flew supplies up, but then we flew these American crewmen back out. So we were operating there for a while until we got them all out. And from my base in Cairo, where my nominal job was chief pilot, I left quite a few air crews up there because we opened up regular transport runs into the Soviet Union. Our relationship with the Soviets was very, very close. We were treated very hospitably. One thing we noticed was that there were no, you might say, combat-age Russians in the whole area. There were young folks there. In fact, the perimeter guard at the airbase we stayed at up there, which was nothing but a field and no construction on it at all, just a field, were 13, 14-year-old girls armed with automatic weapons. And you never saw any 20-year-old, 30-year, 40-year-old people, men or women. They were all in the battlefront. And from Mirgorod, you could hear the guns. It was only that far over toward Kiev where the fighting was going on. So the Soviets were... I saw much of the war, Italy and Europe and Japan. I never saw devastation to equal of what you saw in the Soviet Union. The city of Rostov was just rubble. It had been laid waste for so long that the seedlings of trees were growing up in the cellars and in the streets, and the city was going back to being a forest. It was just unbelievable to see things like that. I saw Hiroshima. Now, Hiroshima was horrible, of course, but you could see that it was a temporary act, and it had happened only a couple of weeks before we saw it. Rostov had laid bare for years, you know, while the Battle of Stalingrad was going on and all. So the Soviet experience was very interesting. I've been asked, we had Russian maps, but as you may have read, the Russians don't make accurate maps of their country on purpose. At least that was what they used to do. And we knew our maps weren't good, but our Air Force had one set of maps that was pretty good. They were the maps that had been used by the crew that flew Wendell Willkie when he made the big round-the-world trip in about 1940. And they had those maps in Tehran. And I was briefed on the flight from Willkie's maps, but they wouldn't let me take them. But they gave me copies, And they said, now as you fly, mark in as many things as you can to try to, you know, we get a little more accurate mapping situation. And we needed it badly because we had no alternatives up there. If we had bad weather or something, we had to go to the bases we sent to. There were no electronic aids to land by and that kind of thing. So they gave me a camera. Well, this kind of flight, I didn't know whether I should be taking a camera because although the Soviets were allies, they might not appreciate that. But anyway, I took the camera and took an awful lot of pictures for them. But it shows that even in July of 1944, and we were strongly allied with the Soviets, there was always this idea that we needed to know a little bit more and that what they were telling us wasn't exactly accurate. It's kind of interesting to see what things like that meant from the peak of the war period to modern times. You see, it has a little implication about things to come when you see little bits of it like that as being asked to take a camera on that trip. I don't think any of our airplanes took cameras, just mine. Well, after 19 months of that rather interesting work, I was transferred back to the States, checked out in four-engine aircraft for ocean flying, and in January of 45, I began flying the Pacific and doing the same work, heavy transport work. In those days, we would fly by way of Hawaii and Kwajalein or Tarawa to New Guinea, from New Guinea to Biak Island over to Leyte. Leyte had just been invaded in the Philippines, and a place called Tacloban. And here we were close to combat. We'd be landing at air bases that were themselves under bomber attack almost every day. Or at Tacloban, the airfield was simply a part of the beach. We hadn't been able to get inland at all, and the fighting was going on in the hills just over the beach, and we could hear the fighting there, so we'd only stay on the ground for a short time. The day I arrived at Tacloban for the first time, we were just approaching the beach when we got a call to circle for a while. Aircraft carrier had been sunk, or at least damaged, and the aircraft carrier's aircraft, all that they could get in the air, were flying to Tacloban to land there, and oh, they came in like a swarm of bees, and the base wasn't it wasn't the kind of a base could handle a lot of airplanes. And some of them had trouble on a runway. They had flat tires or something. And they just took a bulldozer and pushed those planes into the ocean. And then they called on me and says, okay, the strip is clear. Well, I'd seen quite a bit of warfare, but I had never seen this kind where when you're right up into the combat situation, anything goes. You know, you just do what you have to do. And here were these perfectly good fighter planes, except maybe for a flat tire, and they just push them in the ocean and then clear the base and you go in. That was our, and we, most of our flying out of the Philippines was with wounded men. They had not been able to build hospitals, and we had to get them back to Hawaii to the big hospital. And we did a lot of flying in those days just for that purpose. Then we got into Manila, and I think one thing about Manila that hasn't been emphasized enough in history was that that city was horribly destroyed by the approach of MacArthur's armies and the bombing, the artillery and the bombing. It was a terrible destruction in Manila. It was not an easy battle to recapture Manila. I think some people think that once we got into the Philippines, we retook the Philippines easily. That's not so. After that, I was on a flight to Okinawa, which the battle was still going on in Okinawa when we were there, or just ending. They were wrapping up the battle. And we heard that the atom bomb had been used before, about a week before. We heard that the Japanese had surrendered. Well, of course, that's what we were all waiting for. This was August, August 28th, maybe, that the Japanese had quit. And they held us there until they were able to open an airbase in Japan where we could fly in. And I think there was a typhoon, a terrible typhoon came up the coast and hit Okinawa very hard. In fact, I think it is still believed by meteorologists that the highest winds ever recorded were recorded on Okinawa that day. While I know we sat in our airplanes, 155 four-engine transport plane, all night long with the engines running as though we were flying, so we could stay pointed into the wind, but stay on the ground. And with all kinds of trash flying through the air and everything, some of the planes were hit pretty hard, but I kept four engines running all night long, actually flying into the wind and staying on the ground. And in the morning, surprisingly, when we got up, all our planes had been turned 180 degrees around as the storm, you know, we had to follow the winds, and the storm blew us around, and we'd been facing, I think, to the south at night. We woke up, we were facing the north, and an enormous storm, unbelievable. But the plane wasn't damaged, and the next day we flew up to Tokyo. And
do you remember what day that was?
That was on September 2nd, 1945. And it's a memorable date because we approached in the aftermath of the storm. We didn't see anything of Japan as we approached, but just miraculously, well, not miraculously, I had a good navigator. I had a very good navigator. I saw through the top of the clouds the tip of Mount Fujiyama. Huh. Well, if you know one peak, one fix, clearly you can make a letdown in the clouds. So we let down into Tokyo Bay, which is a large body of water. We knew it would be safe to let down. And what we saw there was a line of U.S. Navy ships and the battleship Missouri at the apex of the Navy group. And it was on that same date, September 2nd, 1945, that the Japanese signed the surrender before MacArthur and the other generals there in Tokyo Bay. Well, we circled over the, near the fleet, we wouldn't circle over them,